Session number 12673, Reel 2.
Mr. Hill, Reel 2.
Okay.
Right.
Well, this, as I say, this plane was converted for a so-called passenger flight. Anyway, we took off, and we did have a stewardess aboard. She was very, very nice to us. She knew that we were terrified. I mean, I don't think any of us had been up over 20 foot. And the first stop we made was Malta. We had a night in Malta, because the journey actually took 7 days. Well, believe me, you can fly in a few hours, but this was 7 days. And Cyprus, I'm trying to think, Haifa in Israel, Albania in Iraq. We used to have a day and a night there, because the plane had to refuel and probably put the nuts and bolts back in again. Colombo in Sri Lanka, which was Ceylon in my day. Karachi in Pakistan, and then we had a flight then of about 9 hours non-stop to Hong Kong. Correction, Singapore. Singapore to Hong Kong, then Hong Kong to Okinawa, Luzon in the Philippines, and then finally we landed at a place called Kure in Japan. Now, what you got to bear in mind in this, that we had only more or less left our mother's apron strings, and there we were in the Far East, Japan. I mean, that was another enemy of us. And well, they took us in a coach to a camp, and when we got there, it was a terrible place. I don't remember it, and we managed to say, you know, find out that well, you know where you are. No, we don't know where we are. Well, you're in Hiroshima, and I mean that was a shock, because I thought, well, you know, this is where the atomic bomb dropped, because there was a camp just outside of the perimeter of Hiroshima. And always remember, we were there virtually to be trained finally for the war in Korea, but it never took place, because the first night they let us out, we went to the local cinema, an army cinema, to watch a film or whatever. And we had a group number. I think our group number was 267. And all of a sudden, the film was stopped, and an officer had come aboard. He said, "All those troops in 267 unit, please report back to your camp immediately." And of course, what the hell's that? That's us lot. We all got up. We were then kitted out. We were given made sure we had a rifle. We had a new rifles given us. We had bandolier of 303 bullets. We had to get our kit, and we went on to the airport again as a landing strip run by the United States. And next thing, we're off, and we're flown to Seoul, the capital of South Korea. In other words, we were in Korea to start our experiences in Korea.
When did you arrive in Seoul? Which month?
April 1951. It was 1951 then. April 1951.
Had the Battle of the Imjin already taken place?
We arrived in Seoul, and we were taken to... We were on our way to the Gloucester positions, and we came up the valley. I can't remember the name of the valley. I could never pronounce the names, but all I remember was there was a hell of a lot of machine gun fire, which really frightened us, because we were fresh out of England. I mean, we didn't realise. I mean, the only gunfire we'd heard previously, that was in training. And I remember we were sent, we were designated to go to Able Company. Well, on the way up to Able Company, we were stopped by various other officers of other, saying you can't get up there because the A Company is under attack. You have to come back into what they call A Echelon. That was echelons along the battlefront. And I remember that during the night we could hear a queer sound, and we found it later to be burp guns, and what the Chinese used to use, the burp guns. And we could feel hear the bullets going over, you know. You could. And the next day, there were dead Chinese all over the place. I remember there's the first job that they gave me, and a young Southampton nipper who's now dead. Go down into the gully and just chuck some mud or dirt over the Chinese bodies. They were soldiers, they were killed during the night, and that was our first job. Just cover them up so that they wouldn't smell. And that was when I think you really grew up. You knew you were in, this wasn't for laughs, this was for real, you know. And
what did the bodies look like?
Well, they were riddled with bullets. I remember, and this is a true story. I mean, I remember the sergeant, who was a hardened soldier. I mean, he'd been there a few months before us. He said, roll him over, and we rolled him over, and his head stayed where it was. In other words, his head was severed. We got shot right across the neck. And that was just about enough to, you know, finish us youngsters off. But as the time went on, you got hard. You really, and I mean, I think this is what I was trying to tell you in the car. You were really resentful to think, what the hell are we doing in this godforsaken country? England's not under threat. You know, you were taken away from your civilian life. You never volunteered. You were, because the law of the land was that all those men at 18 years old would have to go as national servicemen. But you never realized that you were going to be in a war. And let's face it, what everyone says, it was a war. I think they call it the Forgotten War. But it, I saw some terrible sights out there, you know, and devastation, not with the Korean people themselves. And anyway, we
how many of these Chinese bodies do you think that you covered?
Oh, 20-30. I mean, they must have come across a machine gun nest that the Gloucesters had opened up and caught a lot of them, you see, because the Chinese, their method of fighting was in manpower. It was an honor for them to get killed. They would send, say, 40 Chinamen up a hill, knowing that those 40 would get killed. But in the process, it would draw the fire with the British troops or the United Nations troops, whereas Britain would be more, the British troops were more strategic. They would work out, well, you know, we're not going to take that. But that the Chinese used to just throw everybody at the enemy or at their enemy. And I mean, they lost thousands. I mean, that there was one incident there that they used to use their dead bodies as barricades, where the first wave, they always reckoned that the first wave would get wiped out, would get killed, and the second wave would use their bodies to barricade. This is a true fact.
Did you cover any Allied troops there, or were they just enemy troops?
You mean, was there any Allied troops with us?
No, when you were covering the bodies with earth.
No, it was only, we were a British brigade, the 29th Brigade. There's three British battalions in that. That was the Gloucesters, 1st Battalion of Northumberland Fusiliers, and the Royal Ulster Rifles. That was the 29th Brigade. I mean, remember the Brigadier Brodie, who came to see us, more or less welcomed us to Korea, if you could call it a welcome. And he paid a compliment that we were national servicemen, but we were more or less going to be treated as old regular soldiers, because there was a mixture. You had regular soldiers, you had reservists that had been called up. They were troops, the soldiers in the Second World War that had been demobbed, but were still reservists, and us kids, as they called us. And they more or less blended us in with them.
What happened to you after the burial of these bodies? What can you remember happening to you next?
Well, then we were given a position. Our hill number was 235. And that was overlooking the banks of the Imjin River.
When you say we, who was given
the
that?
The Gloucesters.
Your battalion?
A company of the Gloucesters. We were positioned on hill 235. And that was overlooking the Imjin. You could look down onto the Imjin River.
But how would you join the company in the first place?
Well, after the confusion of the first night, Captain Mardell, I believe he come from Portsmouth. He mustered us together and said that we couldn't get up to A Company because A Company virtually didn't exist then. And he was trying to form a company to come out of the front line because the main body of the Gloucesters were surrounded by Chinese. And that's where they made their stand. But what messed it up was that there was a small gorge that the Gloucesters was trying to get out from. But unfortunately, a Filipino tank unit were coming up to support the Gloucesters, and the first tank got a direct hit and blocked. And we could see this, and I remember that we had to climb over this tank, and we came out with this Captain Mardell from Portsmouth back to another echelon. And I remember the survivors of the actual battle came in the next day. We had a mingle, and there's a photograph in, I think you'll find in that book there, Now Thrive the Armours. And we had a speech given us by the new commanding officer, because Colonel Carn had been captured. He won the Victoria Cross. And he said, we are now operational again, although, you know, he was full of it, but we didn't really want to know. And then that's when we were sent up once again to the positions that were vacated by the Chinese on this hill 235. And what we had to do then is to cross the Imjin River periodically. Different companies would do this, and it always used to seem that A companies patrol was on a Saturday afternoon, and we had to go out more or less on what they call a recce patrol to make contact with the Chinese troops. And I remember very often we did meet them, and the idea was to more or less direct the artillery, the 25 pounders that were 7 miles back, to direct their fire on the Chinese positions. And this was more or less was the duties that I performed out there. We were mortar bombed. Chinese, one night I remember there was a hue and a cry, and it was the Chinese, the only time they used their 4.2 mortars on us. A lot of youngsters got wounded and hurt.
Can you describe what happened in the mortaring?
Yeah, you could hear all of a sudden the whole hill sort of explosions wherever they're indiscriminate. They weren't accurate in their. They just located where the positions were, and you could hear these mortar bombs coming down, and all you could do was just lay flat, with your hands over your head, because we had lived more or less lived in slit trenches. And of course, the doctors and nurses came up, and all of us were more or less at that particular time under the weather. And you ever saw that program on TV, MASH?
Yes.
Well, I've been to one of their MASH units, and it was a time when all of us caught ringworm. Because, of course, you remember, you couldn't wash any sense, and we were manky, let's face it. And I remember that the American nurses and all that, they were lovely. They really were. They looked after us. And then suddenly, you were fit enough, back you went to your positions again.
Was it easy to cure?
For me, no, because I've got it in the groin, and I have to powder myself regularly in hot weather. I seem to split eight once again. I don't think I ever really got over it.
What were the symptoms of ringworm?
Well, you were actually the word ringworm. You come out and all its rings appeared on all parts of your body, and it was caused by not being able to wash. You couldn't wash. I remember we did one day come to the banks of the Imjin River when we knew that the Chinese weren't anywhere about. And I remember we got in the Imjin River to have a wash, and then the medical officer went crazy because he said the river was polluted by dead Chinamen, and we were washing and all that, and but it was just nice to have water. We thought fresh water, but it wasn't. And I mean, the conditions, how can I describe? I mean, any soldier that's been in the front line, it's not a life of luxury. You've got to make do. I mean, wash. I mean, we virtually, the only thing I think I can remember we did get one day was new boots, because you weren't even allowed to take your boots off, because you never knew. If you took them off, you couldn't get them back on again. And
why not?
Well, because of the heat at that time, your ankles used to swell. And as I say, the powers to be detailed that you keep your boots on as long as possible until you couldn't stand it no more. And then you virtually chucked them boots and socks away, and you got kiddied out with other stuff. Now, remember when we all got this ringworm, it was a very degrading sort of a situation. We all lined up, and the medical officer said, take everything off. And we stood naked, and we just piled our stuff into a heap, and they poured petrol on it, and they burnt a lot, and then they issued us with fresh stuff, you know, all new, clean sort of uniform, battle dress. And what else can I remember?
When you were on these recce patrols, are there? You said you ran into the Chinese.
I can give you a story about what actually happened to me, and this is a true story. This particular day, we had to go on a recce, as they called it. And I was a wireless operator. And we went about 10, maybe 12 miles. A point, a map reference where you had to go to. And we never saw, we never come in contact with any Chinese or nothing. And the idea was, as soon as we got to this map reference point, it was a brew up, we had a cup of tea, have a little rest, have a smoke, have something to eat, eight of your K rations, and then make the journey back to your own lines. We did this. We're on the way back. Now, it's like everything else in the army. After you've done your duty and you think that you're safe and you're coming back, you sort of straggle out. You don't sort of march in single file In other words, I was getting tired. I had the radio set on me back. I had my earphones on. I had the aerial stuck up in the air. And we always put a union, a little tiny Union Jack on the top of the aerial. And after a while, it became that I was near enough the last one in the column. Because you could see the Imjin River, and you was more or less like a, how can we describe it? You see a race on TV, you know, you get the front runners and you get the straggler. Well, we were at the back because the patrol was over. We thought that was over. We're just making our way back to our own lines. It didn't really matter who got back first. And I remember that I turned round and I could see in the distance another column of troops. And I thought, well, I wonder who they are. And then you had references of who was out on patrol that day. And I thought, oh, that's the Kiwis, the New Zealanders. They are coming back. And I'm gradually getting slower and slower. And this column's getting nearer and nearer. And I hear over the radio, code sign, Birdcage One Able, whatever it was. You had different, I couldn't remember it now. Will you mind getting a spurt on Soldier? Because you're leading a Chinese column in. And I suddenly realised it wasn't the New Zealanders, it was a Chinese column that was following me. Well, Bannister might have been the first bloke to run the mile in a minute. Don't believe it. I run it in half a minute. I mean, I panicked. And I remember that we were on the other bank of the Imjin River, and we had to cross, and there was a couple of Royal Engineers blokes, and they, come on, for God's sake. And I just literally fell in the boat, and they brought me back to the banks of the Imjin River. I no sooner got back there, and I got a right royal telling off from the officer, you know. And next thing, there was all out because the Chinese had arrived at the position that I had just left. And of course, our blokes were firing at me. There was another little battle going on. But if anybody was nearer to being captured or killed that day, it was me that day. I mistook them for the New Zealand, and it was the Chinese.
Any other incidents you can remember from the recce patrols?
Yeah, I remember one incident. We had to go out at night time, and I always remember this. And we had a wonderful sergeant. He really was a mother to us. Sergeant Lahine. He was more or less the boss, but you did everything he told you. He was an old soldier. He knew it. And he said to us, right, lads, we're not crossing the Imjin River tonight. We've got to stay this side of the Imjin River because we got to find out if there's any Chinese infiltrators coming through, which was nerve-wracking because you realise then that you were on the wrong side of the Imjin River during the night. I mean, we always used to say the north side of the river was at the enemy, the safe side of the river was our lines, and we had to spend this night in more or less the enemy territory. And I remember we had to be on guard practically, but he used to let two or three of you have a nap. And we were right down by the water's edge, and I remember sort of having a doze. You could have a cigarette, providing you put your cigarette in a tin so that the red, you had to sort of smoke it like that, as long as there was no light, because I reckon the Chinese could pick up any light that was showing on. Oh, all of a sudden, I thought, God, what's the matter? I'm half wet. What it was, the tide had come in the Imjin River, and where we were sleeping on what we thought was dry land was the bed of the river, and we were actually covered, and we were like near floating. And we had to stay in those positions for 2 or 3 days. And what they did, this is the incident I'm bringing up, was that the Americans dropped parachutes with rations, because we had to have something to eat. So the old Dakotas used to fly over and drop parachutes with food, you know, ammunition, all that food, which we had to go out and collect. But Sergeant Lahain, he wasn't interested so much of the supplies. He wanted the parachutes because they were pure silk. And I remember he said, well, get the supplies, but I want them parachutes, because he said, when I get home, if I get home, my daughter's going to get married, and I want to make a wedding, get a wedding dress made out of the silk. And we got these, and of course they were so big. So what he did, he cut them in sections, and we all stuffed bits and pieces in your pockets and that. And actually, we did bring them home for him when we come home, which I'll tell you later on. Another incident was that another patrol, I think you might be interested in this one, talk about a cock-up. We had this patrol, and the 2.2 mortars, when you went on a patrol, every man of the company, of the platoon rather, had to carry a part of the weapon, which meant to say that one bloke would carry the muzzle, one bloke would carry the firing pin, and the rest of us would carry the mortar bombs. Until you got in a position to use it, then you'd fix it all together, and you had quite a lethal weapon. Once again, Sergeant Lahain, off we go. We get to the position on the map where we had to go, and the officer realized that there were some Chinese in another position. So he said, right, fix up the mortar, we're going to mortar these Chinese. So out comes the muzzle, out comes the base plate, out comes all the bombs. The two gentlemen that were going to fire these mortars, if they got the position right, they got the sights right. Then goes the first bomb. Now the idea was, when the bomb goes down, there's a fixed firing pin, and when the mortar hits that, automatically it fires. They dropped the bomb down, nothing happened. Took it apart, and what they'd realised, it's one of us, one me, had forgot to bring the firing pin. So we carried all that weaponry mile and mile, sweating our eyeballs out, was useless because somebody forgot to bring the firing pin, which made the sergeant quite unhappy, made the officer quite unhappy, but it was a big laugh afterwards, after you get out of the incident, and it's like everything else.